Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A recent survey by the Pew Research Center reveals that Americans are more concerned than ever about protecting their privacy, both online and off. The survey also indicates that an increasing number of people are dissatisfied with the ability of institutions to keep their data safe. Joining us now by phone is Mary Madden. She's senior researcher at the Pew Research Center. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thanks so much, Ann.
What are some aspects of privacy that Americans feel they are entitled to?
Well, findings in this report show that Americans really hold a range of strong views about the importance of privacy in their everyday lives. So, for instance, being in control of who can access information about you. About 9 in 10 Americans say that's important to them. And controlling what information is collected is also critically important. However, what this study shows is that only about 1 in 10 say they feel as though they have a lot of control over how information is collected and used. So there's this tension where Americans really want to have more control. They don't feel that they have it.
How knowledgeable are they about how secure the data is? Do we know that?
We know that Americans feel as though they don't know enough and they would like to do more to protect their privacy. So we have this sense that Americans can't really keep up with all of the different ways that their information is collected and used in everyday life, and it's overwhelming to them. So one of the unique things about this study is that we did surveys, but we also did various focus groups as well, where we were able to ask people in their own words to describe, you know, some of these questions about daily life and where they assume in their daily lives they are going to be watched and observed, where the places are that are important to them to really preserve a sense of privacy. But I think for the most part, Americans feel as though they don't know enough and they would like to know more about what's happening with their data.
How are they trying to secure their data? Because we're talking about a couple different things. We're talking about data, and we're also talking about their everyday life and their where they go and who they see.
That's right. And so when we look at sort of the actions that people are taking to manage their privacy online specifically, we see that there is a sort of a big gap. It's often called the privacy paradox between the level of concern and the level of action that's being taken. And so we see that when we look at a range of sort of privacy-related activities, things like clearing your cookies, things like even more sort of first-generation privacy-protecting activities, things like refusing to, you know, provide your real name when a website requests it. Things like that are not as common as you know, are not as high as the level of concern. In other words, you have a lot more people saying that they're worried about this stuff and not as many taking action, particularly when it comes to more advanced privacy strategies, things like using encryption or, you know, using VPN. Those are sort of leading edge activities that really only about 10% of Americans are currently engaged in.
I said earlier that the survey indicates that an increasing number of people are dissatisfied with the ability of institutions to keep their data safe. And I was wondering which of the various institutions stood out among those for being, well, for having the least confidence.
Yeah, so we asked about 11 different kinds of organizations in the survey, and the degree to which people felt as though they were competent in these institutions' ability to keep their information private and secure. And we found that among the groups who ranked the lowest were, of course, online advertisers. People have very low level of trust in them, but also government agencies. So just 6% of adults say they're very confident that government agencies can keep their records private and secure. Another 25% say they're somewhat confident. Landline telephone companies have, you know, comparably low levels of confidence. And credit card companies are a little bit better, but still we're talking about a minority of adults that feel as though they're confident these organizations can keep their records secure.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a recent survey by the Pew Research Center that reveals that Americans are more concerned than ever about protecting their privacy, both online and off, although they aren't necessarily taking things into hand to assure that. My guest is Mary Madden. She's senior researcher for Pew Research Center. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. In your report, what did you learn about where people expect to be monitored the most?
So we asked about a range of different scenarios. One of the things we asked about was surveillance cameras. And so it was striking for us to see that a large majority of adults say they now expect that when they go outside, they will most often be their movements will be captured by surveillance cameras. However, they're not necessarily okay with that. It's just that that is the reality that they've, come to know. So we find that about 8 in 10 adults say that they feel as though it's very important, it's important to them that they not be observed without their permission in daily life. And so this issue of permission keeps coming up, this issue of control, and this sense that, they don't want to be observed if they have not explicitly allowed it. And so I think that really starts to connect with some of these conversations around the NSA surveillance reform efforts, this issue of permission and control. And we find that a majority of Americans say they would like to see greater limits placed on the government monitoring programs. That was something that was also striking.
Was there any correlation in your conversations with them between those concerns about government surveillance records and Edward Snowden and the NSA?
Yes, absolutely. And one trend that stuck out in this study and also in earlier studies that were part of this series is that the more Americans had heard about the government monitoring programs, the stronger their views were on a lot of these measures. So, they felt as though it was, more important for them to retain control. They felt sort of less confident in the ability of various institutions to maintain the privacy and security of their data. And also they felt more strongly about placing limits on government surveillance programs. So while 65% of all American adults say there are not adequate limits on what telephone and internet data the government can collect, we find that 74% of those who have heard a lot about the programs say that. So there really is an effect there. Again, getting back to your question about knowledge and awareness, that does matter.
Are there any places that people felt were truly off limits at all? Was that the cell phone thing or the phone data?
Yeah, so we did ask specifically about we use this battery of questions that actually has been asked in various surveys over the years. And our study and our sampling is a little bit different, so we unfortunately can't point directly to trends over time. But we have a range of questions that ask about things like not being disturbed at home, for instance. We found that 85% of adults feel as though that's important to them. Being able to share confidential matters with someone you trust is also just an essential element of having a sense of privacy in daily life. 93% of Americans say that's important. But when we get down to things like, again, being able to go around in public without always being identified, people don't feel as strongly about that. And not being monitored at work, only 56% of Americans say that's important to them. So I found that to be a really interesting sort of signal of what's become much more common in many workplaces, which is sort of this assumption that, your email and other activities might be monitored.
They know all the BuzzFeed quizzes I've taken, that is. Do Americans feel that government surveillance should be more limited or more regulated? Because there's also this concurrent theme in our society that we're afraid of things. We want security.
That's right, and that's certainly a tension that Americans in our survey felt and expressed. And you can see that on some of these questions where you have a high number of people saying they don't know to a given question.
Mm-hmm.
On the question about limits, you know, we do see that clearly a majority, 65%, say they're not adequate limits. That doesn't mean that they don't support any use of, you know, these technologies to help thwart terrorism. And we find when we ask a different set of questions where we sort of drill down into, you know, the different people who might be monitored, that Americans are more likely to be okay with specifically targeting suspected terrorists versus, you know, monitoring all American citizens, for instance. And so it's important, you know, who you're targeting. I think Americans have a sense of that. And they do also have a sense that, you know, certainly there's a large segment who recognize that this is not, you know, a simple issue. And so I think that's something that's broadly the case with, you know, anything connected to privacy. It's in something we've seen in earlier studies is that it really matters the kind of information you're talking about. Americans have different sensitivity levels when it comes to, you know, things like their health information is quite sensitive, for instance, you know, their location information. But when you get down to something like their shopping habits, for instance, they don't feel as strongly about that. And so it's true that not all data is created equally. And also, I think in terms of sort of who's being targeted, what's the trade-off in terms of security, that becomes a pretty complicated and nuanced question.
What about our identities while we're online? How few of us really understand how thoroughly we are known online by the different agencies collecting information about us.
That's correct, and I think it's also the case that even people who are researching this topic can't say they have a thorough knowledge of that. And I think, you know, that's something, this sense of not knowing and not having any control over that, that level of sort of uncertainty and vulnerability is something that really came through. You know, a lot of the findings in this report speak to a lack of trust. And that's something that's, you know, been a broader trend, that sort of levels of trust in government specifically have been at their lowest levels in many years. And so that's sort of the underlying meta trend here. And, you know, it's, I think people are trying to figure out how they can, how this is going to impact them in their daily lives. And for the most part, you know, you're not seeing a lot of people reporting things like, you know, I couldn't get a job, or I had this, you know, huge reputational harm because of this data that was accessed. But you are seeing an increase over time in the number of people reporting some kind of personal data breach, whether it was identity theft or having an account compromised. And that could be something like, you know, an email or social media account taken over. You know, certainly that happening alongside the constant stream of news about, you know, data breaches and various large institutions being hacked. Just last week here in our area, the Blue Cross, the local Blue Cross Care First network announced that they had a data breach. And so, you know, it's hard for people to keep up with this in everyday life. And that was something that, you know, really resonated with us, particularly as we talk to people in the focus groups.
Well, Mary Madden, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mary Madden, she's senior researcher for Pew Research Center. We'll have a link to the research that we were just talking about that reveals that Americans are more concerned than ever about protecting their privacy, both online and off. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Online transactions are fast. You see what you want, you click on it, you dish up a credit card number or online payment code, and it's all over but for the delivery. Same cannot be said for person-to-person money transactions. In that case, banks and other financial institutions intermediate exchanges, often charging transaction fees that delay the process and burden the parties. That's where Bitcoin can come in. Once seen as a risky fringe investment and the preferred currency for illegal online transactions, the online pay system of Bitcoin is starting to garner some positive attention. Joining us now by phone is author and New York Times reporter Nathaniel Popper. His new book is entitled Digital Gold, Bitcoin and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money. Welcome to the show, Nathaniel.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So trying to reinvent money. For starters, give us a primer on Bitcoin, what it is and what it does.
Sure. Well, I think there are a couple of metaphors that are helpful for understanding what is, for many people, a rather confounding topic. People get sort of their eyes glaze over when they hear about Bitcoin, but there are some simple ways to imagine it. I think that the easiest way is to think of it as a sort of digital token, an online token that is scarce, sort of like gold. So there's only going to be 21 million of these Bitcoins ever created, and so that creates a scarcity that makes it seem possible that they will be worth more in the future than they are now. That's the part that most people know about. There's a whole sort of system underneath that supports these tokens, and that's quite important. And I think the easiest way to think about that whole system is that it's sort of like email for money. It's a network that allows money to be sent between any two addresses anywhere without having to go through any middleman. So similar to email, where all you need is somebody's email address to send them information. With a Bitcoin address, you can send Bitcoins to anyone anywhere and not have to go through, you know, a bank or, and in the case of email, the post office.
There has to be that initial transaction, though, right?
You mean the initial transaction of moving from dollars to bitcoins?
Right.
Right. Well, if Bitcoin are to assume any place in the ordinary world, people are going to have to want to buy them with their dollars. Obviously, the long-term vision is that people are just using bitcoins. And if you could get paid in bitcoins and then pay for your goods in Bitcoin, there is that long-term vision. And in fact, there are some people who are already living that way. There are enough websites and businesses that will sell things for Bitcoin. And there are some companies, obviously mostly Bitcoin companies, that pay in Bitcoin. And so there are some people who are trying to live just on Bitcoin, not dealing with what they call the fiat currencies, the dollars. But yes, for the most part, if this is going to succeed, people are going to have to be able to buy Bitcoins with dollars. And as you might be hinting, that's been one of the big things standing in the way of Bitcoin's growth.
Also, a current value of one Bitcoin is about $235 US, but it fluctuates all the time. Are there denominations of Bitcoins?
Yeah, I mean, this is sometimes viewed as one of the benefits of Bitcoin, although it can go either way. But you can sort of subdivide a Bitcoin into tinier and tinier pieces. Unlike with the dollar, where you get to a penny and that's as low as you get, with a Bitcoin, you can keep subdividing and subdividing, so you can get, you know, millibitcoins, and there are sort of specialized names for it. But it's not as though you just have to own one Bitcoin or zero. You can own all the parts in between.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about Bitcoin with the author of a new book on the topic, Nathaniel Popper. The name of the book is Digital Gold, Bitcoin, and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money. Love to hear from listeners. If you've ever used Bitcoin, give us a call and tell us what your experience has been. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, Nathaniel, if the people who are listening now who have used Bitcoin are anything like the guy who created it, or the people who created it, they're not going to call in and tell us a darn thing. Your book attempts to tell the history of Bitcoin. What can you tell us about the people or the person who created it in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating history. And honestly, even if somebody has no interest in ever using Bitcoin, the story of how this rose is, you know, kind of stands on its own, and that's what drew me into this. I mean, it's a real tale of our times, the motivations that got people excited about this, and it's evolved. You know, what it began as was a group of hackers, essentially, particularly in the 1990s. Experimenting with this idea of creating a new money that couldn't be traced by the government. This was a group called the Cypherpunks, and they were very afraid of the ability of government to sort of track our every moves. You know, these are the kind of Edward Snowden types and Julian Assange types. They were actually both cypherpunks themselves. And so this idea of a sort of anonymous money was the start of a lot of the experimentation that led to Bitcoin. And there are a lot of different parts that ended up being created that the person who created Bitcoin, who has gone by the name Satoshi Nakamoto, put together in 2008. And that is when Bitcoin itself came into the world. And at that moment, in addition to the privacy issues, you had the financial crisis. And this was actually just a few months after Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. And there were all of these people who were questioning central banks and Wall Street and saying, wait a minute, how are the people who are managing our money so bad at this? We need an alternative. And into that breach, Bitcoin appeared. And I think that moment gave this gave a very fertile ground for Bitcoin as it appeared.
You mentioned earlier that 21 million Bitcoins were created, and that's all that'll ever be created. How do we know that?
Well, the pseudonymous creator of Bitcoin, Satoshi Nakamoto, created a bunch of rules that are in the Bitcoin software. And everybody who uses Bitcoin essentially downloads that software and it essentially agrees to those rules. So those rules, among them, are 21 million will be created. A new block of them is released every 10 minutes or so. And so if everybody using it decides together, sort of in consensus, to change the rules and say, okay, we're going to now make 40 million, they can do that. It's the people now who run the network who kind of make the rules. And it's a kind of democratic process in that sense. So they could change the rules, but generally, that wouldn't be a good thing for the people who are running the system, because that would make their Bitcoins worth less. So that's sort of the basis of the system.
Like I said, the current value, as far as I know, is around $235 US, but the price is always fluctuating. Why is it so volatile?
Well, I think in the simplest sense, it's so volatile because people don't quite know what to make of it. The price is sort of a function of the arguments about whether Bitcoin matters. There are these incredibly utopian visions for what Bitcoin can do. You know, there's this sense that it will, once governments no longer are in charge of currencies, they won't be able to pay for wars, they won't be able to collect taxes. And, you know, there's a significant community around Bitcoin who thinks this is going to kind of upend the world order. But then there are all these other visions in between. There are bankers now who are looking at it and thinking, okay, I don't want to replace the central bank, but maybe this is a good way to do payments faster. This is a way to replace Visa. This is a way to do faster bank transfers. And so they're getting into it, but they have a different idea of the value than other people. And, you know, this thing, these coins are going to be worth something if people use Bitcoin. And, you know, some people think that everybody's going to be using Bitcoins, and some people think that this thing is going to die in a year and disappear. And so the price sort of fluctuates with that argument about where this is going.
New York State's top financial regulator has granted a license to a Bitcoin exchange, allowing it to open legally to customers across the country. What's the significance of that?
Well, part of the significance is, I mean, perhaps the most important thing it shows you is that New York State's top financial regulator, Ben Lasky, thought this was important, thought it was worth dedicating time to this. And in my conversations with him, essentially what I heard was, you know, this feels like it might upend the financial system. And so we need to get ahead of it as regulators. And so this regulator, Ben Lasky, has been trying to create rules for Bitcoin businesses. And really the first business to manage to get approval from Lasky is this new Bitcoin exchange called ItBit. And the idea is that it'll be licensed in New York. And so banks, if and when they want to start buying and selling Bitcoins, will have this institution there that's regulated.
How do you regulate an institution that is still so shadowy?
Well, you put rules in to make it less shadowy. And in a sense, you know, one of the things that people talk about being a benefit of Bitcoin is that all of the Bitcoins that have ever been created and all of the Bitcoin transactions are on this sort of global spreadsheet that everybody keeps track of. And so in a sense, it's a very open, transparent system. We know what Bitcoin address owns every Bitcoin. And we know if somebody spends, you know, 1,000 Bitcoins, we know exactly when that happened and what other address it went to. And so in a sense, it's easier to create rules around this Bitcoin system because you do have a record of everything happening. Now, you don't always know who owns each Bitcoin address. And so sometimes, you know, the illegal activity has happened because people have obscured their identity. But it, in a sense, it allows for a more open, transparent system in which it's easier to create rules about what can and can't be done.
If I do business with the Bitcoin exchange that's been granted a license by the New York State regulator, do I lose that anonymity?
Yes, yes. All of these new regulated Bitcoin businesses are basically saying, we are going to keep the identity of all of our customers, and we're going to keep it in the same way that a bank would. And in fact, this new New York business is quite stringent. It's hard for an ordinary person to actually open an account for them just because they require so much. But they're basically saying, the benefit of this system is not the anonymity. We're going to do away with anonymity, but there are other benefits that are still worth the trouble, and that will make it worth it for our customers, even if they do have to give us their, you know, full home address and financial records and all of that.
So let's talk about Bitcoin mining. What is that, and do you have to be rich?
To answer the second question, nowadays you do essentially have to be rich. What Bitcoin mining is essentially, this is the way new Bitcoins are created. I said that, you know, 21 million Bitcoins will ultimately be created. A new block of Bitcoins is released every 10 minutes. And those blocks are released to people who are helping to support the network. So it's sort of like on Wikipedia, if the people who are writing the entries on Wikipedia were getting rewarded with money, the people who are helping to support the Bitcoin system are getting rewarded with new Bitcoins. And it's a somewhat complicated process, but at the end of the day, it's sort of like a lottery. People try to solve these computational problems, and the more you try, the better chance you have of winning. So basically, people need very fast computers to take part in this lottery to try to win the new Bitcoins. And increasingly, you need very specialized computers, hardware, to win this. And so there are companies that have specialized in this, made computer chips just for mining Bitcoins, created data centers full of computers doing nothing but trying to win Bitcoins in places like Iceland, where the energy is cheap. And so it's become a real arms race. In the early days of Bitcoin, if you just plugged your laptop into the Bitcoin network, you could win them. But now, because of the competition, it's very difficult, and essentially only professionals can do it.
So of the 21 million that'll ever be created, how far along are they now? How many are out there now?
We're about halfway through the process. I think something like 12 or 13 million. I need to check that, but it's around there. And the idea is that every couple of years, the number of new Bitcoins in every 10 minutes drops in half. And so right now, you get, if you win a new block of Bitcoins, you win 25 Bitcoins. That'll drop to 12, and then ultimately the last bit of Bitcoin will be released. It's estimated in the year 2140. So this process will go on for some time.
Yeah, it's do you
yes, I hear that hesitation, and I know it's,
what's the next question?
It's crazy, and that's part of what's so amazing about this thing. It's like, why does it make people sort of it both confuses people, but there's this community around this that just thinks it's the most important thing in the world. And people sort of talk about it in almost religious terms, and yet it's this sort of complicated thing that can take you months to really understand. And it's a strange thing, and it's a strange creation, and it's strange how it's risen and gotten all of these followers.
How do you so if you want to get into it, you can buy a Bitcoin, right?
You're right. So,
can you cash out? How do you cash out?
The same businesses that allow you to buy Bitcoins allow you to sell them. So,
okay.
It's like TD Ameritrade or Scottrade. You know, they're essentially brokers where you can go, and they have a price that you can buy and sell at. And they're sort of, make it easy. You can do it with your credit card. You pay a small fee to buy it. Usually a small fee to sell, but you can also just do it in person with somebody. There are these message boards where you can say, I want to meet up and buy some Bitcoins, and you can meet somebody at a cafe, and they just transfer the coins to your Bitcoin address, and you can give them cash, and that's where anonymity can be maintained. You can do it just with somebody. Nobody knows who bought or who sold it, and the Bitcoins have been transferred.
Now, do major banks see Bitcoin as a threat? Obviously, the New York regulator thinks they might.
Well, it's interesting. Banks have very complicated feelings about this. Generally, the compliance departments at banks are not excited about Bitcoin and view it as allowing potentially money laundering, allowing tax dodging, all the stuff that they're already getting punished for. They want to steer clear of it.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, I cover Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, and there are groups inside each of these banks that think this could be the future of finance. This could be the way money looks and moves in the future. And so JP Morgan has a 25-person Bitcoin working group that I learned about in the course of reporting my book. And they're looking at, okay, how might this affect our business? How much could it be competition for us? How much should we be trying to harness it ourselves to do more efficient payments? And so you actually saw Goldman Sachs, I think 2 weeks ago, they made the first big investment that any Wall Street bank has made in a Bitcoin company. And it's a Bitcoin company that is allowing peer-to-peer payments. So instead of forcing somebody to send, if you want to make a payment to your sister or your cousin, rather than sending a check, this allows you to send it to them and they will have it, in 5 minutes. And so that's a potential use of this for the banks. And Goldman Sachs saw enough in that that it led this big investment round in a in an upcoming Bitcoin company.
Well, Nathaniel Popper, I hope you'll join us again to talk about this because it's, you're right. It's, it could go on for months. So
yes, it's already been 6 years, and people thought it would. People have written many obituaries for it, and yet it keeps going somehow.
Exactly. Well, Nathaniel Popper, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you for having me.
Nathaniel Popper, he's a reporter for the New York Times and author of Digital Gold, Bitcoin, and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. As we live more and more of our lives online, using multiple devices in the process, the file storage in the cloud is increasingly common. Now Microsoft is rolling out a new app that will make shifting content between those devices easier. Joining us now to discuss that and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Hi, Russell.
Hey, Ann. How's it going?
Good, thanks. Okay, so Microsoft's new app entitled OneClip basically creates a cloud-based clipboard, very cute, so you can copy text or images on one device and pass them into another. How does it work? Tell me what I just said.
Microsoft's whole focus with OneClip is like you said, it's making your content available on as many devices as possible. And when we think about how we mess with a lot of files today, for people who have to work on multiple computers, we end up using services like Dropbox or Google Drive or something like that, where we have to upload a file to one place and then go to another computer and download a file from that other place. And it just ends up being four or five steps in order to accomplish this thing that, you know, should probably be simpler since all of this stuff is usually either on the same network or using, in many cases, the same apps and services. And so OneClip uses Microsoft's OneDrive service to simplify the number of steps involved in that process. So you can take images and screenshots and audio files and things like that, and across Android devices and Windows phone devices and you know, Windows PCs and likely more. In the not-so-distant future, it takes it so that you can have those files available just kind of instantly across those devices instead of having to go through that multi-step process.
Right. It's a one-step process now.
Right. It ends up being, you know, if it's part of OneClip, then it's available everywhere instantly, and you can have, you know, entire folders set up to automatically sync to OneClip. And, you know, it's one of those things where if your workflow is already kind of embedded in the way Dropbox does things, then it's probably not immediately more convenient, but if you're already using OneDrive or if you've got multiple devices that aren't you know, completely synced to services like Dropbox, then it's a cool thing to check out.
Are there any other apps out there with similar abilities?
Yeah, so you know, like I said, the idea of cloud syncing files is not a new one. It's really just how quickly you can access those files from one service to another. So, you know, like if you have an entire Apple ecosystem, like you're using all Apple products, then, you know, you can do something similar as long as everything is on the same network. But OneClip, what makes it important is that it's across different platforms, okay. Windows and Android and Windows Mobile and all kinds of stuff like that.
How long does the clipboard work for any one switch? I mean, is it in perpetuity or whatever?
Sure. I mean, it's something that you have complete control over. So you can take the file and you know, you can pair as many devices as you want. You can have those instances set to the clipboard. You know, depending on your internet connection, you can have them, you know, grab maybe a lower quality version of it or something like that. But it's something that you have pretty significant control over.
Do you see others then following suit in this way, or does Microsoft I guess, you know, do you see them continuing and taking control of this niche, or do you see others following suit?
This is definitely something that we'll see more people following suit for, because it's set up to, you know, be multi-platform, which is something that we already see, like, Google doing with Google Drive and Dropbox doing with their services. And Dropbox has like a separate split out app for things that they do for photos and you know, making sure that those are available across all of your devices. So it wouldn't be a huge stretch to see Dropbox and Google try and offer something competitive here within the next couple of months, because this is a much easier way of making those kind of short, you know, one-time pushes for files, you know, accessible everywhere. Unlike, you know, the normal, where you take like an entire folder of photos and you store them somewhere because you want to leave them there for a while. You know, this is all about that kind of short transmission of data, which is really useful for people like me, whose Dropbox folder is basically like a teenager's bedroom floor, where there's just crap everywhere.
I don't even want to think about that. So, tech company Asus has a new phone out called the Zenfone 2. It sounds very groovy. The company is mostly known for laptops and tablets. So what's the reputation like in the smartphone realm?
So Asus has been making smartphones for a little while, but not all of them have been available in the U.S.
Okay.
They've been primarily international phones for a little while. And this push to the United States is significant for a couple of reasons. The first is that it is an incredibly low price point. This is actually a really nice phone as far as performance goes. The camera's pretty decent. It's nice and fast when you go to use it, but it's only $300. And that's $300 completely off contract, where you can buy it online and have it shipped to your house for $300, whereas most high-end smartphones that we see are much closer to $700, $800 off contract. And so this ends up being a pretty attractive option for parents who want, you know, teenagers to have kind of their first phone, and they don't want to be attached to a contract or something like that. But it's also, you know, just a decent all-around phone, where it's not the best at any one thing in particular, but it's really impressive what $300 gets you as far as a small portable computer.
What impresses you?
It's really, really fast. And one of the things that we've seen with the less expensive versions of phones over the last couple of years is they end up being just kind of made of mediocre hardware in order to justify that price point.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the software on it kind of ends up running behind, and they just feel like lesser quality devices when you go to use them. The cameras don't feel as nice. The software kind of lags when you go to install a bunch of games on it or something like that. And unfortunately, those devices are being handed to kids who are going to use Facebook and play a bunch of games. And so the quality suffers pretty significantly. But the biggest takeaway that I had from the Zenfone 2 is that it really feels like a high-end phone when you go to use it. It doesn't feel like a lesser quality device.
Like a lot of other new phones, this new version has gone for a bigger screen. What do you make of that? The screens are, it's really, I mean, somebody I know just got another phone. The big screens are a big deal now.
Lots of phones are going towards these larger screens, and we keep seeing them increase in size to the point that, you know, I question whether or not they can even fit in people's pockets.
They can.
And it's right. You know, so it's a complicated thing to say, you know, whether or not we're going to reach a stopping point, because there are places outside of the U.S. where having the larger phone is a bigger deal, because these phones end up being replacements for televisions and even computers in some cases, where, you know, keyboards can be connected, and it ends up being, you know, your one device for doing things.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say, you know, based on usage. I think we'll probably see a little more balance come, you know, towards the end of this year, because Samsung's phones, you know, the Galaxy S6, for example, didn't really increase in size this year, and HTC's phone did really increase in size this year. So I think for the most part, we're sticking between 5 and 6 inches and even that seems, you know, like a pretty big variance as far as screen size goes, because 6-inch phones, I know for me personally, are just really uncomfortable to use.
Now, one other complaint about this phone and many others, actually, is that it comes with a lot of software that's pre-installed. Why do phone companies do this? Why is it a problem? And can you get rid of some of it?
You can get rid of all of it on the Zenfone 2, which is actually kind of nice. Most of the time, you end up not being able to get rid of it. But I think a lot of it is to help offset the cost. Because this phone, like I said, doesn't feel like it should be $300. And unfortunately, some of the business decisions made in putting software on this phone are less than great. There are two antivirus softwares on the phone, which is silly because neither one of them are actually required in using the phone. Hmm. But you end up with a lot of kind of excess junk, really, where the developers have decided to pay ASUS to put their apps on the phone when it is launched. But like I said, it can all be removed on this device in particular, which ends up, being kind of a minor frustration.
I see. They're paid to do it. It's part of their price point. They do it to make money. Okay. On the side. Okay. We're running out of time here. Time's flying. Google is holding its big annual developers conference later this week. Are you going?
I am not going, but my editor-in-chief and one of my deputy editors is going to be going. I am going to be at home dealing with all of the stuff that happens during an event like this because one of the things Google does for their big events like this is actually stream all of their developer sessions. And while seeing new products is a really cool thing, the developer sessions are the things that are kind of most important to me because it helps me learn how applications are going to function moving forward. And so most of what I'll be doing is sitting at home and watching these sessions. But anyone can watch these sessions. If you head to the Google I/O website, there's a list of what sessions will be free to watch and, which ones will be only available at the event. But it covers almost all of Google's products every year. You get, new stuff about Android. We learn about new stuff about Chrome OS, which is their kind of desktop operating system. We're going to learn more about what Google's doing in the car and what they're doing in the television space and a whole bunch of stuff. It's 2 days of pretty much nonstop stuff.
You expect a focus on security, right?
The security is going to be something that, Google is going to continue to focus on. They've pushed it pretty much every chance they get to talk more about how their phones are becoming more secure and how they're handling applications that are coming into the Google Play Store, which is important because, Google's store works a lot differently from Apple's. And so there's the potential for things to function differently and maybe not always the way that you would want them to. And so Google's pretty constantly working on ways to improve that experience.
It now owns the company Nest, which makes smart home technology, right? What do you think you might hear about smart homes?
I think we're going to hear more about the next stage of the Nest thermostat, and there's just going to be a big push towards things like smart lighting and how all of that, interacts together. We don't know exactly what we're going to see as far as, features and anything like that, but this is something that Google has been interested in for quite a while, so we're definitely going to see something.
And what about smart watches now that the Apple Watch is out?
Well, Google's been working on smartwatches for quite a while. Android right. Wear has been out for a great deal longer, and they actually just got a pretty significant update to Android Wear that offers a lot of stuff that Apple's going to have to work pretty hard to catch up on. So I think, instead of focusing on new features, what they're going to focus on is getting more application developers to, offer more complete support for their features.
And anything on Android Auto?
Android Auto, I hope we just hear more about more vehicles supporting it, because it's pretty significant, and it's been out there already. And I know that Hyundai has set it up so that they're almost their entire last year of vehicle releases. People will be able to go to the dealership and actually get Android Auto upgraded into their vehicle, which was announced recently, which is pretty cool stuff.
How recent? How recently will your make of car will you have to have to be able to do that?
I think it's 2014 and 2015 only. I don't actually have the details right in front of me, but there's a list on Hyundai's website. And if you have a relatively new vehicle from them, you'll be able to schedule an appointment with your dealer and they'll take the vehicle for, 20 or 30 minutes and install Android Auto. It'll look like a separate app that'll sit on the dash for that infotainment system that's already built into the car, and essentially you plug your Android phone into the vehicle, and you immediately get that new display.
Well, Russell Holly, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us as usual. Oh, guess we lost Russell a little quick there. Bye, Russell Holly, contributing editor for Android Central. Thanks to everyone for listening today on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.